to Regenerative Mindset. In this podcast, we'll explore fresh ideas and inspiring stories from trusted voices who share practical wisdom on bringing positive change to our lives, our society, and our world. I'm your host, Stacey Pollice. As a psychologist, regenerative farmer, and climate activist, I've developed a deep curiosity for thriving ecosystems. Whether it's on my avocado ranch in Southern California or in the ways we engage with each other. Join me as I chat with brilliant guests who challenge our thinking and expand our understanding of how we can live more sustainably, healthfully, and regeneratively, to give back more than we take. Together, we'll see how personal healing can create a ripple effect that reaches our communities and even the earth beneath our feet. So let's get curious together. This week, I welcome Maria Rodale to the show. Coming from a family lineage of changemakers in the organic gardening movement, Maria is the former CEO and currently serves as co-chair of the Rodale Institute, a pioneering nonprofit that not only coined the term regenerative agriculture, it continues to conduct the longest-running research on the benefits of organic and regenerative practices. What strikes me most about Maria is how she weaves her leadership legacy with her own lived wisdom. She writes and speaks with disarming honesty, whether it's about food, farming, family, or the spiritual experiences that have deepened her connection with the natural world. Her perspective is both rooted in history and alive with imagination, for what's possible when we align with nature instead of fighting against it. In our conversation, Maria shares stories of slowing down, listening to the land, and embracing imperfection as a way back to wholeness. We explore what it means to live regeneratively, not through rules or perfectionism, but through care, creativity, and remembering our place in the larger living world. Join me for this rich, grounding conversation that invites us to rethink our relationship with food, nature, and ourselves. Hi, Maria. I'm so happy you're here today.
Thank you. It's great to be here. It's so nice to meet you.
Finally, yes. And I know I've said to you before, I wish you were my neighbor lady, and that feeling continues. So without further ado, I really want to get into the fact that you are so deeply informed about organic, regenerative. You grew up with a family who dedicated themselves for half a century or so almost to something that many of us didn't know what it was. And I want to talk about your most recent book, Love, Nature, Magic. And for me, it felt like a really radical departure. But then I thought, maybe being in organic farming and regenerative was already a little bit left of center. So could you talk a little bit about your experience of your family history and then bring us up to speed with how you understand all of it now?
First thing to know is that I'm currently writing a book. I've been asked to write a book on the history of the organic movement. So I'm deep in this whole issue of how it all started, how it's all connected. You know, my grandfather, J.I. Rodale, was the one who really started the modern American organic movement. I mean, it had already been happening in England and in Germany, but he's the one who popularized it in America and started publishing Organic Gardening magazine in 1942. I was born in 1962. I grew up, you know, on the farm, in the family business of publishing that perpetuated the whole movement and also the health movement, because we published prevention magazines beginning in 1950. So these two movements have like woven in and out of each other the whole time. And what's interesting for me that I'm learning as I'm researching is I too thought my book Love Nature Magic was like out of left field and kind of crazy. I was even scared to publish it because I thought people are going to think I'm crazy. But, you know, Rudolf Steiner was very spiritual. There's a lot of history of herbalists and shamans throughout the movement who have influenced it and often not gotten credit. So my personal interest is in the intersection of farming, gardening, landscaping, conservation, just nature. You know, everything is nature. And then human health as it relates to that, and finding out what is really the right balance that we can trust to keep us healthy and to keep the earth healthy beyond seven generations. Because it's possible. It's totally possible. And it's really fairly simple, actually. But it's not something that we've been educated or trained in how to look at the world in that way.
Well, it's interesting you talk about educating, and yet what I have only recently discovered is that Rodale has a program within an hour of where my ranch is in Santa Barbara that absolutely teaches all of this. I know about integrated pest management. I did not know about integrated weed management. You know, you have an enemy, or who annoys me now, or where's the grind? And for me, it's around Bermuda grass. And I have a team of interns, and our food garden space that we have, agroforestry, we have various kinds of projects going where we can learn and trial things. But Bermuda is a nightmare for us. And so I just learned there's many ways to approach weeds. And I'm learning, but I didn't know it was there. And was there ever an effort to take this education broader? I mean, over the years that y'all have been doing this?
Well, you know, I skipped over a whole bunch of our history. And so my grandfather started the Rodale Institute in 1947. After my grandfather died, my father started what's now the longest running side-by-side trial comparing organic to conventional agriculture at the Rodale Institute. It's been going on since 1981. So weeds are obviously a big issue, still a big issue with farmers. But, you know, from that research, we discovered that organic is as productive, if not more, during droughts and floods. Organic soil stores more carbon, and it's cheaper for farmers to do, although a little bit more work intensive because you can't just spray everything away. But I think that, you know, we're still on the forefront of real weed research that needs to be done. And part of what my book, Love Nature Magic, was about was I was struggling with mugwort as a weed. Through journeying to talk to mugwort, it shifted my whole perspective. And I realized that, you know, what I thought was a weed is a sacred plant in Korea, for example. And, you know, it's used in moxibustion.
Yeah. In traditional Chinese medicine. Absolutely.
Right. It's usually done in conjunction with acupuncture. So there's all these things that we have been taught to see as that's bad. That's a weed that actually has a lot to teach us and show us and heal us. So the Institute has been expanding. We have regional resource centers in California, in Ventura, in Iowa, in Atlanta, in Italy, and possibly some other places that I'm forgetting right now. The point is, we've done enough research, and we're still continuing to do research, to know that organic is the most viable way to go. But as you know, every region is different in how things grow. So to really teach people, we have to be on the ground where people are. And the thing I also forgot to mention is that after the first 5 years of the farming systems trial, my father was the one who looked at the results and said, oh, this isn't just organic, but we're regenerating the soil. We're regenerating the farmers. We're regenerating our health through this process. So he was the one who coined the phrase regenerative agriculture, which is now being picked up and used in multiple ways, both good and bad. So now the Rodale Institute has developed, along with Patagonia and Dr. Bronner's regenerative organic seal, ROC, which you can see on products in the supermarket. And something has to be certified organic to get that seal, but they also have to have an emphasis on worker fairness and a living wage and humane treatment of animals. So it really addresses the kind of quote unquote beyond organic issue, that organic just by itself isn't enough for many people.
It's interesting because on the land we're on, we did get the organic certification, which is a 3-year process here. But after a number of years, because of the quality of the water we get from our wells, we were not able to sustain it because we had to add an acid. Even if it was a citric acid, an organic product, it no longer qualified for certified organic. And that was the beginning where we decided, I mean, I really insisted that we just do all but. And it has evolved from there when I learned more about what regenerative means. And so I'm curious, I mean, the title of this podcast, I'm a psychologist and a farmer, so I call it regenerative mindset. But I'm curious to know how you would casually define regenerative with your deep experience and understanding. How do you experience it? I see it applying to everything we do. That's my point here. And how would you respond to that?
When I returned to work at Rodale after going off as a young woman to do a few other things, my dad hired me to work for the Regeneration Project. And my title was Coordinator of Regenerative Spirituality and Psychology. Even back then, we were looking at regeneration as like a holistic approach. You know, my dad used to talk about how it's like, if you cut yourself, your body heals. If a forest gets burned down, it heals. It returns to life. It's disruptive and it's terrible, but it will heal itself. And so for him and for us, you know, regeneration is this inherent process of healing that we have to tap into and almost kind of get out of the way of by working in balance and harmony with nature.
This concept came to me because I suffered a liver failure and because I was taking a supplement that I didn't know was toxic to the liver. And by clearing that, my body was able to come back to health. And after that, I realized I'd been doing climate change psychology work and I thought, what's my next move? And I literally heard, climate change is an inside job. And it's like, what does that mean? And I realized that we ourselves have to basically remove toxic obstacles to our flourishing. And I'm curious if this process that you underwent during the pandemic, it seems that your real shamanic journeying took off. Sounds like maybe you were aware of it before then. Tell us about how that may have been a healing, a return, or a restoration for you.
Actually, I learned how to do shamanic journeying at Esalen a long time ago. And I was doing my own personal seeking. But part of what I was looking for with going to Esalen was that, you know, the publishing business was failing, as all publishing businesses are. You know, I was looking for other ways we could fulfill our mission. So I used it personally for a long time. And like you, I got a lot of messages about how, like, really, we have to heal the human heart, our own hearts. It's not our job to save the world. The world doesn't need saving. We need to learn how to heal ourselves and spread that wherever we go. I've seen it all from being in the natural health, alternative health space to the organic space. And full disclosure, I take vitamins. But, you know, vitamins are not a regulated business.
Don't I know? Supplements are a multi-billion dollar industry that kills people sometimes.
Sometimes, yeah. So there's a lot of like hucksterism in the health world and people are looking for miracle cures. And, you know, we made tons of money in the weight loss business, you know, diet books. And yet people are fatter than ever. No shade on the Ozempic thing, but we don't know how that's going to play out over time. And it's just one of those things where a lot of the things we think we need, we don't really need. And a lot of the things that are out there are really not necessary. And if we can kind of simplify our lives, simplify what we eat, what we buy, how we live our life, I'm not talking about going off the grid or anything. I'm just talking about like being reasonable. Then I think the climate change issue is solved. But there's other issues that need to be solved too. It's not just climate change.
What I observe is wherever there's a quote unquote hack to health, or a hack to profit, or a hack to productivity, that's where I see us getting into practices that may or may not align with the way Mother Nature really actually works. And that's been my education the last 5 years. Having gotten a PhD, my learning in the fields of permaculture and food growing and regenerative, it's been a huge education and I'm still on it. And that's what this podcast is partially about. I'm learning from others. But understanding that there actually are rules of the road with nature, and that when we diverge too far and think we can dominate or hack, that's where things go south.
As I'm writing and researching for the history book, I'm seeing it over and over again that what that hack culture is really like guys wanting to get rich. Anytime somebody wants to get really rich, they need to create something and create a need for it that people will pay them a lot of money, even if it's just like angel investors, you know, have their exit strategy and sell it to somebody. I just watched Ken Burns's documentary on the Dust Bowl for background of my book. And in a way, it's the exact same hacking farmland, you know, over farming. The tractor comes out, it's a new technology. We're just gonna like plow fields all day and all night. And oh, we forgot that it doesn't rain in this region. There's nothing to hold the soil down anymore. And it took, you know, 10 years and thousands of people dying. And the solutions were not technology. They were understanding how nature works. And I see the same thing with AI and Bitcoin right now. We talk about water. I mean, water is a huge, huge issue going forward. And what finally helped to solve the Dust Bowl was tapping into the aquifer underground there and irrigating the farmland. But when you over irrigate, you also salinate the soil, which makes it toxic. And I'm from California. We have too much water. So not my area of expertise, but I'm sort of saddened to hear about your water issue, not being able to let you keep the organic label.
Right. And so that's just not going to be possible as long as the restriction disallows us from using an organic substance to rebalance the water or so that the tree can actually uptake. But what it led us on is another process. So everything we're doing is we're not getting a premium price. Our avocados go in a bin to all the outlets, to all the Costcos of the world, with all the others, the conventional farmers. And we're surrounded in this canyon and in this county by conventional farming. We're one of the only people we know of that doesn't use Roundup or glyphosate. And, you know, I heard you say that organic, the profits are as good. Well, I imagine that would be if we got the premium and you say there's more labor involved. And in our case, labor is so much more expensive than let's say it is in Mexico, where 80-something percent of all avocados come from. So competing in these markets, I mean, it's complex. But yet, ethically, I have insisted that we continue to do what we can. And we've used grants that were available, and some have dried up under the current administration. And it seems that we're rolling back definitions or beliefs about what's going on. I'm wondering, I mean, you're at the forefront of all of this. Are you finding that yourself, that the current administration is undoing our knowing and our progress?
Oh, totally. And, you know, from the beginning, there's always been a push and pull between what is the best and pure organic, you know, what does that mean? And then industry and governments trying to influence things and change that and weaken results. But, you know, so much of the cost differentials is, you know, like you said, very complicated economic, political. There's subsidies, there's tariffs, you know. So I do not see the current government helping in a positive way in any of this, but I could be wrong. We can be hopeful, but definitely there's a lot of changes happening right now. So it's kind of hard to say what's going to happen.
I want to get a little bit more into your most recent book that really delves into a communication with nature, plants and critters, and weather, climate. And you mentioned that it was actually terrifying making this move and publishing something, this sort of left of center, based on your own experience based on something that Jung called, I would say, active imagination. So it does have some legitimacy with a psychological field. But I feel that being a woman of a certain age, I see that we have the same hairdo, it has allowed me to delve more deeply into things that were considered unusual or woo-woo. And I'm finding how integrated my imagination, my spiritual connection, my sense of oneness with all things on the planet is actually informing me in a more full way. But I don't know that I could have done it when I was a younger woman, trying to make myself valid or whatever.
Definitely aging has its massive benefits that we have been told don't exist, but are actually magical and wonderful. In my case, it was the combination of getting older and more confident in what I knew and what I didn't know, but also selling the company. Because as I was CEO of a pretty large publishing company, and when you're CEO, everything you say impacts everything. Editors, advertisers, customers. I had to filter myself quite a lot. And, you know, everything I wrote went through corporate communications, for example, to approve it. In fact, that's why I called my Substack Life Unfiltered, because, you know, for the first time in my life, I don't have corporate communications telling me, oh, you can't say that, Maria. You know, that's not going to go over well. So sometimes I cross over the line, but it just gave me the freedom to explore what I really wanted to explore. And that was the combination of shamanism and spirituality and nature. So I was really glad when it didn't kind of completely blow up in my face when I published it.
Well, and it's given me tips for how I might approach some of my own issues. And personally, I journal. And in the morning, I write whatever comes to me. I write my dreams, which are prolific. But I also like to look at what's annoying me today. It's interesting. It's like, what are my, sometimes I call them my churns. Like, what's churning? And I think that's a brilliant place to start. And that's where you seem to start each chapter. Can you say something about that? Like, who's bugging me in my garden? But it, like, can we take that beyond the garden?
Well, yeah, the whole book started because in the early days of the pandemic, I identify as a landscaper who grows food. You know, I don't sell anything. I'm not a farmer. So, you know, I'm at home and I'm like, I'm going to have the most perfect garden ever. It's going to be better than Martha Stewart's. You know, it's going to be awesome. And I'm out there like weeding mugwort, which is just like all pervasive. And there's no way you can get rid of mugwort without chemicals. So I was really annoyed. And that started the first journey. And that journey was like so surprising and shocking to me and shifted my perspective. That's the thing, you know. It shifted my perspective that I was like, I'm going to write a book about all the things that annoy me in my garden. And that's how it evolved, because what I found is that things that annoyed me actually had things to teach me. And the more I learned and dug deeper into their history, their symbolism, their usefulness, their purpose, it made me understand my own purpose and my own self in a much better way. And it's ongoing. It's like you open a door and nature then starts constantly communicating with you, which is really nice.
Right. It takes a certain amount of humility and openness. And I was thinking that the quality of this book, well, I want to contrast it with Organic Manifesto. I mean, that title is very strong. And what you offer in that book, I just want to say, is every factual research, scientific reason why organic is the better answer than chemical or conventional. But what I would say the difference between those two books maybe is what Jung again called that judging versus perceiving qualities in the Myers-Briggs test. And the judging is yes, no, right, wrong, kind of binary. A cutting of a way of doing things, which has its value, but the opposite end of the spectrum would be a perceiving. And that type, which is what I am, more wants to understand and to kind of fill in, how does this work? Why does this work? So I really saw those two books as really taking opposite tacks.
Well, when I wrote Organic Manifesto, I was really annoyed back then too. Basically, being annoyed is a part of my personality. But what I was annoyed at was, you know, so I had spent my whole life in the organic world, but the popular perception at the time was, oh, local is better than organic. It was like, organic is so like, it's over. It's really now about local. And I was like, this is not the right conversation to be having. It's not either or, it's both and. So then I realized, even though I grew up in the organic movement, I didn't really understand it all. I hadn't read a lot of the key books. You know, I hadn't really delved too deeply because, you know, my day job was a business person. I was in business. So that was a really good education for me to write that book, because in writing and researching, I was able to understand all the better. But Love, Nature, Magic was just a lot more fun and a lot more organic. You know, I wasn't trying to prove anything to anybody. You know, I wasn't trying to tell you that you need to journey or eat this and don't eat something else. What's interesting is this next book is really more of a combination.
Well, history, research, gathering facts, gathering dates, times, what happened when. I mean, of course, we each put our filter on history, as we know. And what you're trying to do is create a balanced historical piece of data information for people to refer to. How did this happen from the perspective of a mature woman, which I find interesting? You know, this reminds me, I follow your Substack and I saw one of your more recent posts, Everything is Out of Control, which I think control is such a great word. It's a vulnerability I don't know if we've ever not had as humans. I don't know. Does it come with being human? I don't know. But what I notice about your writing is quite often there are subliminal almost. It's like, we need to hear more from women. Women need a voice in our culture. And it's almost like woven throughout everything you write is about gender inequality. And I'm wondering if you'd like to say something about that relative to the big picture here.
Whew, that's a big one.
Well, it's one of my interests.
I mean, how could it not be if you're a woman in this culture? Yeah, I've been researching and studying women's history for most of my life. And that stems from also studying religious history and trying to understand women's role in religion and, you know, how that all plays out. And then, you know, you have these experiences. So I was a single mother for like 8 years until I got married. So I didn't have a man to rely on. So I had to work. I had to be the breadwinner. And that energy continued throughout my life, even when I was married and had more kids. I experienced so much misogyny throughout that time. Like, I'm not a PhD psychotherapist, but I also love watching people and learning. And what I noticed is that sometimes we women are our own worst enemies, and we have a lot more power than we think we have. And we've been taught, especially at our ages, to be nice, to wait for permission, to not offend people. You know, men don't have those rules placed on them. They have other issues just as confining. But, you know, I really early on realized, oh, how we are treating women in this society is how we're treating nature. And neither of them are really valued in our economic system. That's a problem. And that's something I am committed to exploring, exposing, communicating about, and hoping to shift the understanding about that. It starts with each of us owning our power, speaking up, not waiting for permission, and not caring what anybody else thinks.
Well, I would say that my own process with getting involved in a farm that my husband actually bought, started, created, and for many years, it was a place that we spent time where we lived. And then after my near-death experience, I became deeply connected and started studying and became a voice and insisted on being a voice. And what I learned is a woman in farming is a very rare breed. And I was often dismissed because of my views and my ideas and my gender of being a fairy farmer. And then I decided that actually, I'll take that and I'll say I'm actually a fierce fairy farmer. And you don't fuck with the fairies because they embody everything that is alive, depending on how you want to define it. So that was something I did notice is the male-dominated agricultural industry and masculine. It's like scientism almost, I want to say, is not science, but scientism.
One of my truths that I've learned over time is that science and facts don't change people's minds. Men will deny it, but you know, they're not chemically farming because of science and data. They're chemically farming because they don't want to be kicked out of the club. They don't want to make a mistake or embarrass themselves by having a messy field. I say like a clean field to a chemical farmer is the equivalent of like a manicure and a blowout for a woman.
Oh my God, you're so right. And it runs deep.
Yeah. So it's about shame. It's about fear. Control really is about fear. You're afraid of losing control. So you try even harder to control something. So it's definitely more psychology than science. I mean, psychology is also a science, but.
Well, you know, it's funny because changing a mind versus a change of heart. And that's what I'm really trying to get at with what I'm doing is to get underneath things so that we can help people feel and understand how does this feel versus how does that feel? Because once you go there, it doesn't matter what the facts are in a way. It's moving.
Yeah, we have found 100% the doorways into organic are mothers who get pregnant. They're creating a child and they want it to be safe. Or anybody, male, female, young or old, who gets deathly ill, sick. And that's when they're like, I need to, you know, eliminate chemicals from my diet. And oh my God, I feel so much better. So, you know, the real challenge is how do we create those aha moments for people where, oh my God, I feel so much better without them having to get deathly ill or get pregnant unless they want to. And that's where I think just having people over for dinner, feeding people real food, getting people onto your farm so that they experience and feel it. When people come to the Rodale Institute, I can guarantee you in the first 10 minutes, they'll say, oh, this place is magic. Because they just feel the aliveness. And once you've felt that, you can also feel the deadness of other things.
I have to concur. And people, when they're on the farm here, Elwood Canyon, they feel the difference. I don't know what it is, but I just feel great when I'm here. And we had our first tour last week, and they were students from the university, but so excited. And it makes me think that's going to be a next place for me to go, is to actually bring people out here. And the thrill of eating food that comes from the land, that's another essential, exciting, thrilling thing for people, I've noticed. This thing that you touched on of shame and making mistakes, that was one of the barriers I came up against with my husband, God bless him, was when I said, what if we did it this other way? What came crashing down on him was, oh, I've made a mistake. I've harmed the earth. I've harmed the food I'm producing. I've harmed my family and my community. And literally, it was a marital issue for us, not a joke. We duked it out for a few years. And I had a spiritual conversion, I think is what happened, with my own healing from a near-death experience, quite literally, on the death's door, that I couldn't turn back. I couldn't not know what I knew. But it took, I would say, somewhat of a spiritual conversion. And that sounds like what you're talking about with childbirth. I mean, that's a spiritual conversion if you've ever done it.
It's a near-death experience.
Yeah, it is, quite literally. Yeah. But then also people who become mortally ill or close to it. There's a club almost, you know? I mean, not to exclude anyone, but that is an understanding that not everyone has. And I think we came up to climate change feeling like a collective NDE, and now we're backing away from it possibly again.
Again, through studying history, the history of the movement, there's been waves of like the world is ending. I remember going back and reading one of my dad's books that he wrote in like the 70s. And he's like, by 1985, you know, it's the end of oil. There will be no more oil. So that was a big movement back then, the end of oil. And, you know, here we are, we still have oil. And then religious people throughout history have always been like the rapture, the world is ending. And there's some kind of like thrill that people get thinking about the end of the world. And I think maybe it's like a seeking of a near-death experience, actually, you know, because you think, oh my God, if the world is ending, what will I do with the rest of my life? But the science is so interesting and complicated. And I do believe in climate change, but I also think a lot of things are contributing to it. And I think the answers are actually pretty simple and doable. So obviously switching to organic and regenerative organic, I mean, immediately will make the soil more absorbent of carbon and water, you know, so there'll be less flooding, you know, making sure that we're not overdeveloping land, which causes flooding. That's as much to blame for flooding as climate change, you know, because we're building on places that shouldn't be built. We're reducing the permeability of land, you know, and then the whole renewable energy stuff, that's just human stubbornness that we're not already farther ahead on that. Looking at communities differently so that we don't have to drive as much. I mean, this is something that young people long for. And I find the older I get, I long for, you know, I want a small town where I can like walk and get a really nice clean salad at an affordable restaurant. But where I live in Pennsylvania, you have to drive everywhere. And there's really not that many great places to eat. So enjoy your time in California, because it's not like that out here.
So I just inadvertently spent 2 months in Italy, in Bologna specifically, because my husband had a gallbladder crisis. I mean, it wasn't ideal circumstances, but I was there for 2 months in a culture that does value community. I mean, they have the piazzas and there's places everywhere to gather. On Saturday and Sunday, they shut all the streets down for pedestrians. I mean, you can drive, but please don't. And they don't. And many stores close because they want to rest and enjoy. I can eat a meal not having to worry about where it came from and the quality of it, because they just don't believe in poisoning their people. I have to imagine we all started there. How did we get here? It was just such a pleasure and it relaxed a part of me. I want to imagine a future where being poisoned by my life isn't a factor for me to worry about.
I mean, I think that's the new American dream that we all should be working towards. I would love to see 20, 30, 50 years from now where applying chemicals to the land is illegal. I mean, it should be illegal. And a lot of the chemicals we use here in the United States are illegal in Europe and even in China and countries where those chemicals are made, they're illegal. It's the Industrial Revolution that really created the sprawl that we live in. And when you study history, you realize that like, even though 100 years seems like a long time to us, it's really short in the scheme of things. And things that we think will last forever are completely transformable. You know, one of the things I learned from shamanism is that rather than being like, oh no, the world is ending and oh, we're all gonna die, it's like, okay, no, we dream the future. So what is the future we want to create? Let's start dreaming it. Let's start imagining it and building it in every aspect of our lives.
I absolutely concur. I've had a Power of Intention group every Wednesday at noon for over 2 years. And it's been proven, Lynn McTaggart has proven, that the power of intention and the power of prayer, whatever you call it, which prayer I think is just naming your vision or asking the universe or your God, however you organize, for that. And I believe that is a huge power that we can reclaim, is the power of our own intention. The other thing I see, I mean, it's in the title, is love is such a pervasive message from you. I had a dream decades ago that psychology was all parlor games. The only thing that heals is love. And it was one of those dreams where I woke up gasping for air going, oh, you know, so it stayed with me. It's been a pillar of my path ever since. And you say love is a path. Can you say what you mean by love is a path?
So, I mean, I think we're all presented in our life with different challenges. And it's easy to get lost in anger and resentment and vengeance, but learning how to love actually is deeply healing. And I think partly because I grew up not having the love I felt I needed. It's a story for another day, but I didn't feel like I was seen and loved, you know, so I was constantly looking for love and searching for love, like I think many people are. You know, I had a lot of mistaken paths of love. And before I wrote Love, Nature, Magic, I actually wrote like a 200,000 word book called Learning How to Love. And I tried to sell it to publishers and nobody wanted to publish it. And partly because I don't have a PhD, I'm not an expert, and my prior sales weren't good enough to say, oh, this is going to be a bestseller. And I also realized I had written it as a self-help book, and I don't want to be a self-help writer. You know, I don't want to go on the workshop. I don't want to sell my services. I went down a big path, what I thought was the path of love that I was supposed to go on, but it hit a dead end. And what was interesting is the act of writing Love, Nature, Magic and journeying, I learned how to love through those journeys to things that annoyed me and understanding things from their perspective and what it was like for them, what it's like for the mosquito. I mean, I still don't love mosquitoes.
Who doesn't hate mosquitoes? But what did they teach you?
So many ads in the 50s were like, DDT, it's the end of mosquitoes. You know, we'll end mosquitoes forever. If we actually succeeded in that, then like we'd kill ourselves because the mosquito larvae are like the primary source of food for all the things that keep the web of nature alive and healthy. So, you know, fish eat them, frogs eat them, birds eat them, other beneficial insects eat them. So it's like when we try to kill something else, we're actually trying to kill ourselves. And so we have to learn to live in peace and harmony with the things even that annoy us. And that made me feel love. It wasn't just an intellectual thing. It was a feeling. So I try to bring that to everything I do. I'm not perfect. I still get annoyed. I still get mad at people and things. But always when something comes at me, I'm like, okay, choose love. Don't choose vengeance. Don't choose meanness. Even if it's funny, I'm constantly attempting to choose love, even though I don't always succeed at it.
Well, you said a few things there about I'm not perfect, but that's not the goal. Everything you've said up to this moment is like, that is not a goal whole. Let's say that's what soul retrieval is in shamanic journeying, is we're returning back parts of ourselves that we've had to let go of. And love, to me, the way you're describing it, and I believe the way I understand and practice it, is inclusive. And a loving approach or attitude is one where you're willing to be open and learn something new that you didn't know, so that, wow, I was a little off in the way I was thinking about this. When you think about relationship and how we are in relationship, it's like you can be right or you can be close. You pick, because the two don't always go together.
In my situation, I was always looking for love externally in a relationship, and I'm divorced.
So am I, currently married, but divorced.
But so I'm not in a relationship with anybody now, and I haven't been for like 8 years. So it's been a process of learning to be complete in myself, provide myself with the love that I thought I would get from somebody else that I never have.
That's big. That's profound. And really, as my Buddhist teacher Tenzin Wangyal likes to say, is that awareness within is really the great mother of all witnesses. There's nothing that compares, because that is connected to your own divine. And so there really is no mere mortal outside of ourselves who can give us the witness and the love that we truly desire.
I firmly believe that, you know, we're all both male and female, and how that manifests is different, but internally we have to balance the male and female sides of ourselves to feel that wholeness.
Well, and Carl Jung, one of my mentors, again, had a lot to say about the inner masculine and feminine. as well as he used alchemy, which was an ancient practice, spiritual practice, but also a chemical practice that was about that conjunctio, that union of our inner opposites. And everything in nature is. So another key takeaway I got was we are nature. Is that a crazy concept for people? Or is that just duh? Like, how could we not be? But it seems that we have positioned ourselves above nature, outside nature.
It's like a duh obvious thing, but it's also something that a lot of people, especially I would say like the Silicon Valley, you know, tech people who are like just an iteration of previous groups before them that are like, man is superior to nature. Man is separate from nature. It's man's job to have dominion over nature. Like I heard about 12 years ago, it was at like this private banking conference, and it was, you know, this AI expert talking about the future of AI, and he was painting this picture, you know, of how the world would be. And afterwards I went up to him and I said, where do you see nature in your vision? And he's like, it's there, just like it's in the Jetsons cartoon. I literally went back and looked at the Jetsons. It's like, there's no nature in there. So you have this kind of like immature male fantasy of like, you know, Elon, you know, we're going to go to Mars, but we're going to destroy our home in order to get to Mars. It's a fantasy. It's this like a drama triangle, you know, hero, perpetrator, victim, the desire to be the hero and save the day, but without being kind of grounded in the reality that there is no real such thing as a hero or a perpetrator or a victim. We're all just human nature.
Well, so I want to touch on magic because it's a way I do experience life. And I'm currently working on a book that is a departure from my favorite thing, which is academia. It's a very hard thing for me to do. And my working title is I Never Meant to Be a Farmer. So like, how did I get here? I didn't set out to do this. So what I'm finding is my stories often involve a synchronicity, a dream, a vision or auditory bit of information. I like to say I come from Orange County, and whether you know what that's like or not, it's very suburban grid. You know, it's like, that's not what we do. And yet it turns out I'm quite intuitive. I have a lot of senses outside the basic five that I work with constantly. And so that, when I enjoy it and when I accept it, is exciting, enchanting, energizing, and yet there's this legitimacy wall I come up against. And so I'd love to hear how you understand magic.
Well, what you just described is our secret power. That is the female, feminine woman's secret power, is tapping into that intuition. And everybody, male or female, have a direct connection to whatever you want to call it, the God, the universe, source. And it's like radio signals. So there's science to it. It's just science we haven't discovered yet. Like you can't see Wi-Fi, but you believe it exists because it works. And that's the same with our intuition and our synchronicities and our magic.
That's a great analogy, Maria. I love that. Thank you. Because I'm constantly seeking to have my intuition have a seat at the table. And yet every time it's like, where's that coming from? That's crazy. Love that. It's invisible. We can't see it. We can't prove it. Yet it proves itself over and over.
Proves itself over and over. And I can't tell you how many times when I was CEO, my intuition said, do this. But I didn't trust it because it wasn't what had been done before. And if I would have trusted it, it would have led down different paths. And what my intuition said turned out to be right in retrospect. So now what I do is meditate every morning after I've had my coffee and check the socials. And most of my Substack posts, I don't even know what I'm going to write about before I meditate. And then I meditate and I sit down and I write what I just was inspired to write from meditating. So like I said, it's our secret power.
And are you saying that you think women are more connected than men? Is there some information in that realm? Or based on our giving birth or some other way that we have kept some aspect of ourselves. I'm just curious to know how that is.
I'm hesitant to make bold proclamations, but I do think even the research is women have more ability to multitask or have more endurance. You know, we have different skill sets. Just like men are physically stronger and always will be, we have other strengths. And I think it does come from DNA evolving over time because we need to figure out what a baby is trying to tell us when it's crying, you know, or figure out what a man really wants when he can't use his words. In shamanism, there are just as many female shamans as male shamans. I think men have just as much potential, just as women have potential to be physically strong. It's just a matter of what you choose to exercise.
Well, the term believe her that I know came through the Me Too movement comes up for me because my intuition doesn't come with backup. I don't have a list of sources or why it's true. I just know it's true. And that's the other thing is truth just lands sometimes. And I think all of us have had those experiences. Something just lands and you just know.
Part of the path of love for me is knowing that what may land on me as truth is somebody else's not truth. And that's okay. It's okay for people to live with different truths and to believe different things and not to have it all be the same or my way is right and everybody else's way is wrong.
That is sage advice. For me, the line ends up being, is it harming others? Are you killing anybody? Are you harming people? That would be my line. Well, I could go on and ask you a million more questions because I love it all. I think at this point, I'd love to just ask, what are just a few key takeaways that you would love listeners to have with your deep experience, both in the science, the business, and the shamanic background that you've got with growing things in the world?
First, I'd say start by like not using chemicals on your lawn. Try to remove them, you know, from your house and your food. There's great cheap alternatives to chemicals. You know, you're kind of like clearing your space. So first clear your space and then realize that you really don't need a lot of the things that you think you might need. I always just say, you know, you don't need to detox if you're not putting toxins in your body in the first place. So be conscious and careful about what you bring into your life. You know, once you've cleared your space, be careful about what you bring back in and thoughtful and try to find farmers or stores that are good for the community, good for the earth, bring integrity into your life. And then, like you said, don't harm anything or kill anything. I mean, you can kill a mosquito if it's like buzzing in your ear. In general, try not to be afraid of things that we've been taught to be afraid of. Try to understand them and have compassion for them. And then trust the magic. Trust your voice. Speak up. Be kind and loving. It's simple, really.
That's beautiful, and I couldn't agree with you more, but it's always really good to be reminded. So thank you so much for your wisdom and for being out there on the path and sharing your voice. And now I can't wait for the history book to come.
Thanks. It's going to take a couple years.
All right. Well, meanwhile, I have your Substack account.
Yes, and I will be updating along the way.
For tuning in. If today's conversation inspired you, you can help us reach more people by sharing this episode with friends or leave a review. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For additional resources, you can visit my website and stay connected with me on social media. A big thanks to the amazing team that makes this podcast possible, including Phil Svitek, Brianna Phipps, Leah Pellegrini, Melissa Walbridge, and Courtney Hamilton. When we all work together, we can create a world where positive change is not just possible, but inevitable.